All right, remember, the machine knows if you're lying. First statement, Carvana will give you a real offer on your car all online.
False.
True, actually. You can sell your car in minutes.
False? That's gotta be...
True again. Carvana will pick up your car from your door, or you can drop it off at one of their car vending machines.
Sounds too good to be true, so true.
Finally caught on. Nice job. Honesty isn't just their policy, it's their entire model. Sell your car today, too.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
Welcome to The Deep Dive, the place where we take a stack of source material, feed it through our analytical engine, and hand you back the most potent nuggets of knowledge or insight. Mm-hmm. Today, we are pointing our compass due west, all the way to the rugged Pacific edge of Canada, for a comprehensive analysis of British Columbia.
And we really need that analytical engine today, because BC is not just a geographical location, it's... A study in dramatic and sometimes baffling contrast.
Right.
Our source material frames it perfectly. A land that is simultaneously defined by the mild, perpetually rainy coast and the semi-arid, sun-baked interior.
It's two different worlds in one province.
Exactly. It's a place of vast, protected wilderness, something like 12.5% of its area, sitting right alongside some of the densest and most globalized urban centers in North America.
That tension, that's the key, isn't it? Between the wild, resource-rich land and the highly complex urbanized society.
That's it.
That's exactly what we need to unpack. Our mission today is to cut through the postcard imagery and understand the underlying systems that make BC tick.
From its deep indigenous foundations and colonial resource booms.
Right up to the modern dilemmas of political turbulence and runaway housing costs. We want you, the listener, to walk away feeling immediately well-informed about this pivotal, influential Canadian province.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so let's start with the snapshot, the essential numbers that give us a sense of scale. British Columbia is, of course, Canada's westernmost province, nestled tightly between the Pacific Ocean and that imposing continental barrier, the Rocky Mountains.
And the scale is what first jumps out at you. It covers 944,735 square kilometers.
Wow.
Which makes it the fifth largest jurisdiction in Canada. It's comparable in size to, like, France, Germany, and the Netherlands all combined.
So it's massive. But despite that monumental landmass, it is the third most populous province with an estimated 5.7 million people as of late 2025.
Yeah, and that immediately begs the question of where all those millions of people are concentrated.
Exactly. You have this gigantic province, yet the population is heavily, heavily clustered. Right. While Victoria, located beautifully on the tip of Vancouver Island, serves as the capital, Vancouver just, it dominates the region.
Completely. It's the largest city and the third largest metropolitan area in the entire country.
Yeah.
Metro Vancouver alone accounts for, what, 2.6 million people?
That's almost half the province in one corner.
Exactly. The rest of the province is vast, beautiful, and sparsely populated, which, you know, creates a huge political and economic chasm between the urban lower mainland and the resource-based interior.
A recurring theme, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely. Before we dive into the landscape itself, we should probably mention the official symbolism. BC's motto is that beautiful Latin phrase, splendor sino occasu.
Which means splendor without diminishment. It's a bold, almost defiant statement that speaks directly to the province's immense, self-evident natural wealth.
It really is. But the name British Columbia is arguably a microcosm of the entire history of external influence here.
Oh, that's interesting.
Let's really unpack that etymology because it links British colonial ambition directly to American exploration and even older European history.
Okay, so Queen Victoria officially chose the name in 1858.
Right.
That was when the mainland area was formally designated a British colony, primarily to ensure the land stayed out of American hands during the Fraser Canyon Gold Rush.
So she chose it to distinguish the British sector from the already established American territory to the south, which had been jointly known as the Columbia District.
And that's the key. The Columbia District was defined by the Columbia River system. So where does the river get its name?
It's a fascinating trail.
Mm.
The river was named after the American trading vessel, the Columbia Rediviva.
The Columbia Rediviva, which, if my memory serves, means Columbia Reborn.
Exactly.
And that ship got its name from the traditional poetic name given to the New World, or certain parts of it, Columbia.
Correct. And Columbia is, of course, a reference to Christopher Columbus.
So you have a British colony formally named by a British monarch.
That ultimately traces its etymological lineage through an American ship, back to an Italian explorer working for Spain.
It perfectly captures the messy, multinational, and somewhat accidental nature of how the Pacific Northwest was carved up.
Absolutely. A perfect summary of the whole situation.
Okay, let's turn to the land itself, because the geography here is far more than just scenery. It is destiny. Section 1 is all about BC's extreme geography and the climate paradox it creates.
The physical relief of British Columbia is truly the primary force that determined where people settled, what kind of industries developed, and even how its modern transportation systems function.
Just look at its boundaries. It's flanked by Alberta to the east, Yukon and the Northwest Territories to the north.
And then four U.S. states, Washington, Idaho, Montana, plus Alaska to the northwest. It's the meeting point of North America's entire western rim.
And what dominates that space is just this, this wall of mountains. The source notes that a staggering 75% of the province sits over 1,000 meters above sea level.
Yeah, 75%. This is why when you look at a map of BC, you don't see broad plains. You see mountain range after mountain range.
And that topography is a huge economic constraint.
It is. While 60% of the land is forested, an immense natural resource, only about 5% is actually arable, suitable for large-scale agriculture.
And that tiny 5% explains why the low-lying Fraser Valley and the interior Okanagan region are under such intense pressure for development, both for housing and for food production.
Exactly. Beyond the mountains, we have the coast, the defining feature of BC's global identity. BC is the only Canadian province bordering the Pacific Ocean.
And its coastline is monstrously rugged. It stretches for over 27,000 kilometers when you factor in every indentation.
27,000. It's just a mind-boggling number.
And it's not just a flat beach either. The source highlights that it's characterized by deep mountainous fjords created by ancient glacial action carving valleys right into the sea.
And you also have approximately 6,000 islands, most of which are uninhabited. You could spend a lifetime exploring that coastline alone.
To help us visualize the scale, we've mentioned Victoria, the capital, on Vancouver Island, and Vancouver, the population hub in Lower Mainland. But if you wanted to find the center of the province, you'd be near the small town of Vanderhoof.
And a fun fact, the largest city by land area is actually Abbotsford, which just demonstrates the different metrics we use to define a municipality's importance.
Okay, now let's address the climate paradox. This is a direct, fascinating consequence of all those high mountain ranges.
It really is.
This is where BC goes from mildest to driest and hottest in Canada, sometimes within just a few hundred kilometers.
Absolutely. The coast is entirely defined by the North Pacific Current, a warm, moist flow coming off the ocean. This gives the coastal areas an oceanic, mild, and incredibly wet climate.
Right. In populated areas, the annual mean temperature can be up to 12 degrees Celsius, which is the mildest average in the entire country.
You rarely see sustained snow at sea level.
But the precipitation figures are almost unbelievable. To give you an extreme example, our sources point to Hokutlis Lake on Vancouver Island.
Oh, this number is wild.
It receives an average of 6,903 millimeters of rain annually.
That's nearly 23 feet of rain.
It's just staggering. That amount results from the moisture-laden Pacific air hitting the steep coastal mountains and being forced straight up to condense.
A textbook example of orographic precipitation.
Exactly.
But once that air mass crosses the first two major ranges, the coast mountains and the Cascades, it loses almost all its moisture.
Resulting in a dramatic rain shadow effect.
A huge one. You descend into the deep interior valleys, the Thompson, the Fraser Canyon, the Okanagan, and the entire environment just flips. You enter semi-arid zones.
And these are genuinely dry zones. Certain interior locations receive less than 250 millimeters of precipitation annually. The summers there are intensely hot.
Oh, yeah. Well, Soyuz, a town located near the U.S. border in the Okanagan, averages a maximum temperature of 31.7 degrees Celsius in July.
And that makes it the hottest month of any location in the country, on average.
But the extremes recorded in BC are even more telling. Think about the summer of 2021.
The heat dome.
Exactly. The record high of 49.6 degrees Celsius was set in Lytton in June, and tragically, the town burned down shortly thereafter.
49.6. That's less than 6 degrees Celsius away from Canada hitting 50 degrees.
It's terrifying. And yet you have to contrast that blistering heat with the record cold. Minus 58.9 degrees Celsius recorded in Smith River back in 1947.
One of the coldest readings ever documented in North America.
These figures just underscore the sheer volatile climatic range BC manages.
And, of course, the extended summer dryness in the interior creates the perfect kindling for natural hazards, particularly forest fires.
An almost annual fixture now, whether sparked by dry lightning or human activity. And these hazards are also strongly influenced by the Pacific's macro cycles. El Niño tends to bring milder and drier conditions,
while La Niña brings wetter, cooler patterns.
That's right.
It's incredible that humans have managed to live and build an economy in such volatile conditions. But this rugged, varied landscape is exactly why the province has had such an immense commitment to conservation, isn't it?
Precisely. To protect this biodiversity, 12.5% of the province is legally protected.
Wow, 12.5%.
That's over 800 distinct areas under 14 different designations. It's a massive commitment to land stewardship.
And that includes 7 of Canada's national parks and reserves places like Glacier, Pacific Rim, and Yoho National Parks.
Right. And when you look at the fauna, you realize why this protection is so non-negotiable.
It's a stronghold for large North American species.
Absolutely. You have flourishing populations of grizzly bears, black bears, and that uniquely magnificent creamy white Kermode bear, the spirit bear, which is a subspecies of the black bear found only in this region.
And the marine environment is just as rich.
Totally. It hosts migratory routes for orcas, humpback whales, gray whales, and large colonies of harbor seals.
It paints a picture of immense natural health, but it's important to note not everything is thriving.
No, it's not. The sources highlight several highly endangered species, including the Vancouver Island marmot, the spotted owl, and certain badger populations. The pressure on the land, particularly from development and resource extraction, is relentless.
And we can't forget the plant life. The sheer diversity includes over 2,300 plant species, an immense forest, western red cedar, white spruce, Douglas fir, and hemlock, that formed the early backbone of BC's economy.
Which is the perfect transition. That move from environmental richness to economic power is what leads us directly into the history.
Before we move on to the colonial era, let's pivot back to how the First Nations managed this incredible environment, because it was far from just untouched wilderness.
That's such a critical point to establish. The sources mention the traditional plant foods like berries and camas roots, but more importantly, they highlight the complex, sophisticated land management practices, particularly among the Coast Salish.
Right. They weren't just harvesting. They were actively shaping the ecosystem.
They were. They practiced what is now called forest gardening. They managed and encouraged specific species like crabapple, hazelnut, and wild cherry, using intentional burning and tending practices.
It was a sophisticated, managed ecosystem honed over millennia.
Which directly contradicts the colonial narrative that the land was merely vacant, raw wilderness waiting for European exploitation.
A vital distinction.
And that brings us directly to Section 2, History, Indigenous Foundations, and Colonial Conflicts. To understand modern land disputes and cultural identity in BC, you have to start with the people who were here for millennia and the devastation that followed contact.
The human presence stretches back at least 10,000 years, with Paleo-Indians migrating south from Beringia between 20,000 and 12,000 years ago.
Initially, they were nomadic hunter-gatherers, but around 5,000 years ago, groups began settling into more sedentary, resource-focused lifestyles, particularly along the coast where marine resources were so abundant and reliable.
And this stability allowed for the flowering of incredibly rich and complex societies among the Pacific Northwest Coast peoples, the Haida, the Kwakwaka'wakw, the Nutchinulf.
Their culture was defined by their relationship with the Western Red Cedar. They used it not just for massive communal plank houses, but also for enormous seagoing canoes capable of carrying dozens of people, and, of course, the elaborately carved totem poles.
And the ceremonial culture of the potlatch, that system of ceremonial feasts where immense wealth was distributed and status was established, was fundamental to their political and social structure.
Yeah, cornerstone. And let's not overlook the linguistic wealth. BC is, or was, a powerhouse of indigenous language diversity, home to 34 distinct indigenous languages.
But the source notes the catastrophic decline.
It's tragic. Today, only about 6,000 people speak those languages in total, with around 4,000 being fluent.
Yeah.
It's a sad testament to the impact of colonization in residential schools.
And that brings us to the shadow of contact. This sophisticated, interconnected culture met an abrupt and devastating end with the arrival of European ships.
Which inadvertently carried waves of infectious diseases. The sources are chillingly specific about the scale of the disaster. Smallpox killed at least 30% of Pacific Northwest First Nations in the 1770s after initial contact.
But the true catastrophe was the 1862 smallpox epidemic.
That 1862 epidemic originated in Victoria and spread rapidly throughout the coastal communities, ultimately killing half to two-thirds of the native population.
Half to two-thirds.
It wasn't just a humanitarian tragedy. It created a demographic vacuum that dramatically weakened indigenous resistance, just as colonial officials were planning massive land grabs.
And the land policy that followed was justified by this tragedy.
And by colonial officials operating under the belief that indigenous people were in the way and that colonists could make better use of the land, this resulted in the forced relocation onto reserves.
And these weren't generous parcels of land. By the 1930s, over 1,500 reserves had been established, but they were often intentionally too small, fragmented, and resource poor to support the traditional way of life.
It was a systemic effort to force assimilation and clear the way for resource extraction and settlement.
While this devastation was occurring, the European powers were fighting for claim.
They were. Though the Spanish, notably Juan Perez in 1774, reasserted their claims, it was the British who really solidified their jurisdiction.
You had James Cook's charting in 1778, followed by George Vancouver's incredibly detailed mapping expeditions in 1792 and 1793.
Which established the British presence along the coast, but the claim to the interior was sealed by land. In 1793, Alexander Mackenzie completed his journey, becoming the first European to cross North America overland to the Pacific.
But crucially, the actual day-to-day control was cemented not by the Navy, but by the fur trade.
Right. The establishment of posts by the Northwest Company and later the monolithic Hudson's Bay Company provided the first permanent British footholds. Fort St. John in 1794, Fort St. James in 1806, and Fort Victoria in 1843.
And this set up the conflict that led to the modern border. The area, the Columbia District, was jointly occupied with the U.S. until the 1846 Oregon Treaty finally divided the territory along the 49th parallel.
Britain secured Vancouver Island and the mainland to the north, then known as New Caledonia.
But the defining moment, the catalyst that forced the slow-moving colonial office in London to act, was the discovery of gold.
The Fraser Canyon Gold Rush in 1858. It saw a sudden, uncontrolled influx of 25,000 to 30,000 American miners.
A huge number.
Yeah. This flood of foreigners on British soil prompted London to officially designate the mainland as the colony of British Columbia, solely to maintain sovereignty.
And to establish law and order in this chaotic, newly declared colony, they needed a visionary strongman. They sent Richard Clement Moody, handpicked by the colonial office, to command the Royal Engineers.
Moody's brief was dramatic. He was to transform the new colony into the British Empire's strategic bulwark in the farthest west. His ambition was literally to found a second England on the shores of the Pacific.
So he was a military engineer tasked with nation building.
Pretty much. He immediately set about establishing the new capital in New Westminster, choosing the site for its defensibility and the quality of its deep-sea port. He saw the majestic beauty of the Fraser River, but his focus was always strategic.
And he and the Royal Engineers were instrumental in building the crucial early road network necessary to administer the interior roads like Kingsway, the North Road, and the massive Caribou Road.
He even designated Stanley Park in Vancouver as a military reserve to guard the harbor against potential American invasion. That shows you the paranoia of the era.
Interesting.
However, his tenure wasn't without controversy. He was heavily criticized for large land acquisitions he made through the Preemption Act of 1860, highlighting the blurry line between colonial administration and personal enrichment.
So that initial 1858 rush was followed by the Caribou Gold Rush in 1862.
Attracting thousands more miners. And this is the financial turning point. The colonial administration was forced to finance massive infrastructure projects, most notably the Caribou Wagon Road, to service remote boom communities like Barkerville.
But that road plunged the colonies into staggering debt.
It did. And that enormous debt was the main non-negotiable factor that pushed for unification. In 1866, Vancouver Island and the mainland merged, hoping to consolidate finances.
4 years later, desperately seeking an economic lifeline and desiring connection to the rest of the continent, the newly united colony negotiated its entry into the Canadian Confederation in 1871.
As the sixth province.
And the election that sealed the deal was the one that would define the province for the next century. The Canadian government had to agree to extend the Canadian Pacific Railway, the CPR, all the way to the Pacific coast.
The completion of the CPR in 1885 was arguably the single most important event in BC's economic history. It cemented Vancouver, which was the chosen terminus, as the regional hub.
The resulting rapid growth was so intense that Vancouver surpassed Winnipeg as the largest city in Western Canada in under 50 years.
And resource sectors, mining, forestry, fishing, and ranching expanded rapidly, all driven by the new rail connection to the east.
However, this expansion required immense labor, leading to the immigration of people from China, Japan, and India.
And this influx, sadly, led to severe resentment and racism from the dominant white population.
It did. This resentment manifested in systemic, restrictive measures, such as the discriminatory Chinese head tax, which was designed to limit Asian immigration.
It also culminated in terrifying mob attacks against Chinese and Japanese immigrants in Vancouver in 1887 and 1907.
And the dark legacy continued into the early 20th century, notably with the Komagata Maru incident in 1914, where hundreds of would-be Sikh immigrants aboard the ship were refused entry.
It reflected the deep-seated anti-Asian sentiment that pervaded the political and social climate of the time.
Looking back, the source mentions that due to the prevalence of mining activity throughout the mainland, a common epithet for the region, even after provincehood, was the gold colony.
That simple phrase just distills the entire history of its economic engine up to the early 20th century. BC was born from resources and the debt incurred to extract and transport them.
And that historical reliance on raw extraction versus the needs of a diverse population and a fragile ecosystem is a tension that, as we will see, never truly leaves BC politics.
Never.
That resource pass leads us perfectly into section three, demographics, politics, and modern challenges. Let's look at the modern human landscape, which is arguably just as varied and turbulent as the physical geography.
BC is defined by its contemporary diversity and its famously dramatic political history, starting with the people. BC is the most diverse province in Canada.
It is. The 2021 census recorded the highest proportion of visible minorities in the country at 34.4%.
That's a staggering amount of diversity compared to the national average.
Yeah.
The ethnic makeup breaks down roughly to people of European origins at 60%.
East Asians at 14% and South Asians at 10%.
And Indigenous Canadians constitute about 6% of the population.
This diversity fundamentally reshapes the language landscape, particularly in Metro Vancouver, while English is universally dominant at 96.69%.
The sheer volume of other languages creates distinct linguistic hubs. Punjabi is the second most spoken language at 6.41%, followed closely by Mandarin at 6.36% and Cantonese at 5.01%.
It means that in many suburbs like Richmond or Surrey, Mandarin, Cantonese, or Punjabi is just as visible on storefronts and heard on the streets as English. It's a truly multilingual daily reality.
And we shouldn't forget the officially recognized Franco-Colombian linguistic minority as well, a nod to Canada's national history.
Another striking cultural data point relates to religion. BC stands out on the North American map because irreligion, meaning no religious affiliation, is the single largest group.
Right, accounting for 52.1% of the population.
Over half the population identifies as non-religious. That contrasts sharply with Christianity, which sits at 34.3%, followed by Sikhism at 5.9%.
This overwhelming secular leaning is significant, and it undoubtedly informs the political atmosphere and social values in the province.
And now let's transition to politics, which is often described as a blood sport in BC.
That's putting it mildly. Political history is dominated by massive ideological swings between two primary camps. The left, represented by the NDP.
And its predecessor, the CCF. And the Right of Center Coalition, historically Social Credit, and currently the BC Liberals, who recently rebranded to BC United.
Let's just pause right here because this point is crucial for anyone outside BC. The source explicitly clarifies that the BC Liberal Party, now BC United, is not politically tied to the Federal Liberal Party of Canada.
It causes endless confusion.
It's a critical distinction. The BC Liberal United Party has historically been a free enterprise coalition. It was formed specifically to unite disparate conservative, federal liberal, and social credit voters under one tent, often to defeat the NDP.
So their ideological common ground is fiscal conservatism, low taxes, and resource development.
A policy set that is fundamentally opposed to the federal liberal platform.
So if you hear about a BC liberal premier, you are talking about someone who is economically right of center, regardless of what the word liberal means federally.
Exactly. This structure explains the dramatic swings. You have the NDP, which tends to be highly organized and labor-focused, versus this free enterprise coalition, which, when it unifies, can win massive landslides.
Like the 2001 election.
Yeah, where the BC Liberals won 77 out of 79 seats, a devastating victory for the opposition. Currently, the province is governed by the NDP, which has held a majority since 2020. This back-and-forth volatility is a defining characteristic.
And unlike many jurisdictions, the Green Party plays a highly significant role.
They do. They held three seats and, crucially, were the kingmakers who supported the NDP minority government from 2017 to 2020, demonstrating their meaningful political leverage, especially on environmental issues.
Unfortunately, BC politics is also typified by a long, storied history of scandal.
Oh, yes. The lure of vast resources and real estate wealth seems to perpetually attract drama. This legacy runs from the colonial-era land speculation right through to the late 20th century.
We see the Social Credit Party brought down by the Fantasy Garden scandal, which forced Premier Bill van der Zalm to resign.
Then there was the NDP's bingo gate in the 1990s.
And most recently, the immense public backlash and political fallout over the implementation of the harmonized sales tax, which led directly to the resignation of Liberal Premier Gordon Campbell.
It's almost a political tradition to govern until a scandal overtakes you.
All of this political complexity feeds into a deep-seated grievance regarding federal representation, specifically in the Canadian Senate.
BC feels constitutionally marginalized, and this is where the numbers become stark. British Columbia is severely underrepresented, with only six senators allocated for a population of over 5 million people.
Only six.
If you do the math, that equates to one senator for every 775,000 people.
Now compare that to a province like Prince Edward Island,
which has one senator for every 75,000 people. This constitutional imbalance means BC has less influence in the appointed upper house of parliament, a major point of provincial friction.
Moving into the 21st century, the greatest challenge is the consequence of the province's desirability. BC has reached a critical tipping point defined by a spectacular and often painful housing crisis.
The statistics are horrifying. By 2018, Vancouver housing was ranked the second least affordable in the entire world, second only to Hong Kong.
Second in the world.
The sources explicitly link this runaway inflation to evidence of global capital flows, including massive foreign investment and, critically, money laundering, primarily linked to capital flight from China.
That required extraordinary countermeasures. The province implemented multiple taxes designed to cool demand and punish speculation.
We're talking about the empty homes tax, the housing speculation and vacancy tax, and the foreign buyers tax.
But the effectiveness of these measures is hotly debated. While they raised revenue and arguably slowed price appreciation in certain segments, they have failed to solve the supply shortage at the low end of the market.
It's an attempt to manage a global commodity real estate with provincial policy tools.
And the affordability crisis is so severe that it is actually reversing migration patterns. BC was the largest net recipient of interprovincial migrants for years.
Culling people from across Canada. But that trend abruptly reversed in 2023. The province recorded a net population loss of 8,624 people moving elsewhere in Canada.
And where did they go?
A substantial percentage of those people moved east to Alberta, drawn by much lower housing costs and a robust energy economy. This is a significant demographic shift that directly reflects BC's cost of living crisis.
Finally, we must acknowledge the critical and painful reckoning with the past that intensified in 2021.
The discovery of unmarked gravesites of hundreds of Indigenous children at former Indian residential schools, specifically at Kamloops, St. Eugene's Mission, and Cooper Island, forced the entire nation to confront the devastating and recent legacy of colonial policy.
It was a moment that underscored the fact that BC's colonial history is not a distant artifact, but a wound that profoundly affects contemporary policy, land claims, and reconciliation efforts. In terms of immediate history, the COVID-19 pandemic also had a major impact, resulting in over 2,000 deaths and 250,000 confirmed cases by 2021.
However, BC also stands out for its effective public health response, achieving a very high vaccination rate of 78% of the population over age 5 being fully vaccinated relatively quickly.
Okay, let's shift gears now to Section 4, economy, industry, and connectivity. Given the constant tension between the wild interior and the urban coast, how does BC actually make its money?
And how has the province managed to stitch together these vast, rugged geographic extremes? The shift has been profound.
Historically, it was purely a resource-dominated economy.
Forestry, mining, fishing, the gold colony. While these sectors remain significant, the economic evolution has overwhelmingly favored services. Employment in the resource sector has fallen steadily as a percentage of the workforce.
The source material clearly confirms this modern identity. The economy is now diverse, but firmly dominated by services.
New job creation is overwhelmingly in construction, retail, and service sectors. BC now boasts the highest percentage of service industry jobs in Western Canada, constituting 72% of its overall industry.
72%? That's significantly higher than the regional average.
Within that service sector, the most valuable engines are finance, insurance, real estate, and corporate management, all heavily concentrated in Metro Vancouver. This concentration means the global economy is running right alongside the traditional economy.
But we can't forget those historical resource mainstays because they still feed the global export market.
They do. BC still exports substantial volumes of lumber and timber, pulp and paper, copper, metallurgical coal, and natural gas.
So the province walks this strange line. The wealth is generated by services, but the exports are still largely raw or minimally processed materials.
It's a key tension. Let's shine a spotlight on two major non-traditional industries that define BC's modern global image. First, the film industry.
Hollywood North.
Exactly. Vancouver is globally known as Hollywood North. The source notes it's the third largest feature film production location in North America, trailing only Los Angeles and New York City.
So why Vancouver? It's not just one thing, is it?
No, it's a combination of favorable tax credits, excellent infrastructure, and most importantly, that extreme geography we discussed.
Right. Within a short drive, a film crew can shoot temperate rainforest, rocky mountain peaks, semi-arid desert, and a modern glass-towered city skyline.
That versatility is gold for location managers. Second, maritime trade. BC's economic health is intrinsically linked to its position on the Pacific Rim.
The Port of Vancouver is Canada's largest.
And is recognized as the most diversified port in North America, serving as the country's primary gateway to Asia. This massive trade capacity generates enormous secondary wealth through logistics, warehousing, and financial services.
And when we look at the big picture, BC is an economic powerhouse.
Achieving the third largest GDP in Canada in 2020 at $309 billion. This underscores its critical role in the national economy, even if its politics are regionally focused.
All right, now let's discuss transportation, the absolute backbone. The Rocky Mountains posed a fundamental existential obstacle to settlement and trade.
They really did. Before the 1885 railway completion, the only reliable way to move goods and people was via the Pacific Ocean to ports like Victoria and New Westminster. The CPR wasn't just infrastructure. It was the mechanism that enabled BC to be a truly integrated, profitable province.
The rugged and vast topography means BC requires thousands of kilometers of highways, often hugging cliff sides or passing through deep valleys.
The sources highlight that the road systems were historically, quote, notoriously poorly maintained and dangerous until a concentrated improvement program kicked off in the 1950s and 60s.
And even today, there are only five major road routes connecting BC to the rest of Canada, all navigating those massive mountain ranges.
Right. These include critical passes like the Crow's Nest Pass, the Trans-Canada Highway through the Kicking Horse Pass, and the Yellowhead Highway.
But despite that history of reliance on fossil fuel transportation, BC is now a North American leader in future transportation.
This is a great statistic. As of 2021, the province had the highest percentage of electric vehicles sold, as a percentage of total vehicle sales, of any Canadian province or U.S. state.
That's incredible.
That statistic speaks volumes about BC's priorities. It's partly driven by policy and high gas prices, but also by the fact that BC generates immense amounts of clean, cheap hydroelectric power.
So the EVs run clean because the electricity itself is clean.
It's an ideal synergy. And the urban centers rely on highly developed public transit, particularly Vancouver's TransLink system, featuring the SkyTrain.
One of the world's longest fully automated metro systems.
Serving multiple cities like Burnaby, Richmond, and Coquitlam, and connecting directly to the international airport. It's a crucial component for managing that high population density in the Lower Mainland.
And rail.
Rail remains historically crucial for resource movement, even if modern passenger service is limited. We still have Via Rail operating long-distance routes, and the Amtrak Cascades connects Vancouver down to Seattle and Portland.
Solidifying that Pacific Northwest corridor.
Exactly. And lines like the Pacific Great Eastern, now BC Rail, were vital for hauling coal and timber from remote interior resource communities down to North Vancouver.
For our final deep dive segment, let's explore Section 5, Culture, Cuisine, and the Great Outdoors. This is where the geography, the history, and the high level of urbanization truly translate into lifestyle and global identity.
The culture of BC has a fascinating dual identity, beginning with the incredible depth of indigenous formline style. This is the art found in Northwest Coast indigenous traditions, the elaborate totem poles, the transformation masks, and the detailed Chilkat weaving.
Characterized by those continuous flowing curvilinear lines and ovoid shapes.
Yes. The Western art scene came later and often incorporated this landscape and cultural legacy. Think of the celebrated painter Emily Carr, whose work often fused European painting techniques with indigenous subject matter and the rugged West Coast environment.
And we also remember architect Francis Rattenbury, who designed iconic structures like the Empress Hotel and the Parliament Buildings in Victoria.
Then in the latter half of the 20th century, Vancouver developed its own distinct intellectual movement, the Vancouver School of Conceptual Photography in the 1980s.
This school includes internationally renowned figures like Jeff Wall and Stan Douglas,
who use large-scale, often cinematic photography to explore narratives and conceptual themes related to the city's history, labor, and social structures. It's a sophisticated intellectual contribution to global art.
And today, Vancouver maintains roughly 350 works of outdoor public art, reflecting the city's commitment to visual identity.
The performing arts sector is equally vibrant. BC is the third largest music-producing province in Canada, generating an estimated yearly revenue of $265 million.
Wow.
It is home to the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra, a pillar of classical music, but also launched internationally popular acts across multiple genres, from rockers like Bryan Adams to jazz legends like Diana Krall and crooners like Michael Bublé.
Moving to cuisine, BC's food culture perfectly reflects this demographic and geographic location. Hyperfresh, fusion-focused, and centered on healthy, often local ingredients.
There are two main culinary traditions. You have the West Coast tradition, which is heavily seafood-focused, leveraging the incredibly rich marine environment.
Right. Think Dungeness crab, spot prawns, and wild Pacific salmon.
Prepared, smoked, candied, and chowdered. Then you have the interior tradition, which relies more on the resources found inland. Game meat, curing, and smoking, often alongside the fresh produce coming out of the Okanagan and Fraser Valley.
But the truly unique staples showcase that fusion and regional specialty aspect.
We have the famous Nanaimo Bar, that specific layered dessert that has become the unofficial provincial confection.
With its crumnut base, custard middle, and chocolate ganache top. A classic.
And in the sushi world, the BC roll, which contains barbecued salmon and cucumber, is a beloved local invention.
And for beverage enthusiasts, that staple of coffee shops across North America, the London Fog Tea Latte,
Earl Grey, vanilla, steamed milk,
was actually invented right in Vancouver. In Scotland, they even refer to it as a Vancouver Fog to credit its birthplace.
I love that. And speaking of drinks, the interior is crucial to agricultural wealth. The Okanagan region, thanks to that specific semi-arid hot climate, is a major wine hub, home to 280 licensed grape wineries.
The specific terroir, hot, dry days and cool nights produces distinct, high-quality wines, especially Riesling and Pinot Noir.
They also have a knack for developing unique fruit varieties. The Ambrosia and Spartan apples, two widely consumed varieties, originated right in the Okanagan.
So the success of their specialized agriculture, be it apples, cherries, or wine, is a direct result of those specific, almost desert-like microclimates we highlighted earlier.
Exactly. Finally, the outdoor life and athletics. This is arguably the province's biggest global selling point today. The rugged geography that once caused massive transport debt is now the source of enormous recreational revenue.
The opportunities are endless. World-class hiking and mountaineering in the Rockies, sea kayaking in the deep fjords, whitewater rafting down glacial rivers. The sheer scale of the playground is just unmatched.
And of course, the snow culture. BC is famous for its high-quality downhill skiing and snowboarding. Whistler Blackcomb, located north of Vancouver, was the centerpiece for the 2010 Winter Olympics events and consistently ranks as a top global resort.
The biking culture is equally powerful. A 2016 global poll rated BC as the top mountain biking destination in the world.
Which isn't surprising. The steep slopes, the network of logging roads, and the dedicated trail builders have created an industry and a lifestyle that is internationally celebrated.
A final note on education. BC's K-12 system is notable for its relatively high rate of independent school enrollment, about 14%, which is partly due to generous provincial funding for those institutions.
Right. And while academic achievement, often measured by PISA scores, has been generally high, the sources do note a slight decline in performance in recent assessments since the early 2000s, reflecting pressures facing modern education systems.
This complexity feeds into a diverse array of world-class public universities, including the University of British Columbia, UBC, Simon Fraser University, and the University of Victoria, which continue to draw global talent.
It's a full picture.
So what does this all mean when we synthesize these elements? We've seen that British Columbia is a study in relentless, beautiful contradiction. The mild, the wild, the dense, and the open.
Absolutely. The province is fundamentally defined by massive geographic barriers. The Rockies, the coastal mountains, the fjords, and immense resource wealth.
These two factors catalyzed its complex and often turbulent history.
the devastating indigenous population collapse, the frenzy of the gold rushes, the infrastructure-defining Canadian Pacific Railway, and the political scandals that seem to perpetually accompany the pursuit of immense wealth.
The result is Canada's most diverse society, highly urbanized around two major metropolitan centers, yet still heavily reliant on the vast, remote, and still wild resource heartland.
It's a constant balancing act between the needs of a 72% service economy and the demands of the remaining 28% resource base.
And this brings us to the final provocative thought. Historically, BC was literally known as the gold colony, its identity rooted entirely in resource exploitation.
Yet, its contemporary global image is inextricably tied to conservation and high-quality outdoor life witness, the 12.5% protected land, the high EV adoption rate, and the world-class tourism at Whistler.
So the critical question for the future is how BC manages this inherent tension in the face of modern pressures.
Pressures like climate change exacerbating forest fires, the economic volatility tied to global trade, and the raging housing crisis pricing out its own citizens.
How will this highly urbanized, secular, and diverse population demand that its government balance the enduring need for resource income, the coal, the copper, the lumber, with the fierce protection of the natural splendor that now defines its global image?
And perhaps more importantly, defines its long-term future prosperity.
That balance between the resource past that built the province and the conservation future that attracts the world is the definitive political and economic challenge facing British Columbia right now.
And how they navigate it will influence the entire Pacific Northwest region for generations.
Something profound to mull over as you contemplate that 27,000 kilometers of rugged coastline and the density of a Vancouver high-rise. That's been The Deep Dive. Thanks for listening.